We're doing our special class, The Stories of the Destruction of the Temple. We're in Gittin. We're holding the top, the first wide line, Savur Rabbanan. When the rabbis saw the offering that the Roman emperor had sent, the Iglatilta, we discussed last time, that calf that represents three calves, and they realized that Bar Kamtza had purposely blemished it, so they thought lekaruve mishum shelo malchut. They said, even though it's blemished, perhaps in this instance we should bring the blemished animal as a sacrifice in order to ensure peace with the authorities, with the kingdom. Amalu Rabbi Zecharia ben Avkulas. Rabbi Zecharia ben Avkulas said to them, Yomeru, people will learn from this an incorrect halacha. They will say, Ba'alei mumin kerevin legabei mizbeach, that under all circumstances you're allowed to bring a blemished animal to the altar. Savul miktileid lo lezel velema. They wanted to kill him. He shouldn't report back to the Romans. And here we brought another version that says that the Romans sent along messengers, but they were going to switch the animal so that the Roman messengers would think they brought the Roman emperor's animal. But Bar Kamtza would go back and say, they didn't bring your animal. Amalu Rabbi Zecharia. Rabbi Zecharia said, if you kill him, yomru matil mum bekotchim yareg. People will say he was killed because he blemished an animal. And then they're going to say that anyone who makes a blemish in an animal gets the death penalty. So Rabbi Zecharia ben Avkulas had concerns. And concerns are important because sometimes we're quick to compromise, whereas if we would define our concerns, we could find a solution that satisfies all the concerns. Sometimes it's important to say, wait, here's what we lose if we take this course of action. Because it's you have to be careful. You have to calculate what outcomes are undesirable from our actions, and then decide. But over here, I'll get to you in a second, Bini. Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Yochanan, who's in the process of teaching us the story, says, An vitanutosh Rabbi Zecharia ben Avkulas. It is Rabbi Zecharia ben Avkulas, his patience, that he was willing to put up with Bar Kamtza, he was willing to put up with the danger, he was willing to doubt the moves that would have ensured a more secure outcome. Well, that humility, hechriva et beitenu, destroyed our home, v'sarefa techaleinu, and burnt down the holy part of the temple, v'higlitanu me'artzeinu, caused the soul to be exiled from our land. All of this is his humility. So this is a different point. Initially, Rabbi Yochanan had said, the verse is, you should always be careful. The opening line, Rabbi Yochanan began the story, was, people who weren't careful, they're the people who brought the destruction of the temple. Now Rabbi Yochanan is saying, but Rabbi Zecharia ben Avkulas was too careful. Or perhaps he was careful from the wrong things. Maybe he should have been more careful of the danger the Romans that the Romans were to Israel than the danger of inappropriate learning. His humility. So here we see Rashi says that it was his humility that made it so he was willing to put up with Bar Kamtza. He says that's where Rabbi Zecharia ben Avkulas took things too far. He should have had less humility. He should have said, I'm not putting up with this nonsense. I'm not going to let Bar Kamtza get away with it. Out of humility, he was willing to put up with things he should not have put up with. So that can be a balancing message or an alternate message to what Rabbi Yochanan initially said. Yeah.
Disadvantages
of having an oral
tradition? times of the Gemara, everything was Baal Peh, so maybe someone would get confused just because of the nature of the teaching.
In those days, part of teaching, and still today to some degree, is observing how they do it practically. It's not just a question of what I've learned. If you try to be an observant Jew just based on what you learned, you're going to have a hard time getting it right. So if the students would see that they were killing Bar Kamtza and they wouldn't be able to discuss it too openly because they were under Roman rule, and Bar Kamtza obviously had some kind of connection if he could access the emperor, so then things would have to be confused. They would have to execute him in a way that it didn't get back to the Romans. So then people could walk away with misunderstandings as to why he was killed. Yeah?
If this was like seemingly, you know, a lesson, but he got it wrong seemingly, but, you know, as we know how it turned out, we can say that. As it started in original, you have to look at each case at each time, evaluate each enemy, and, you know, what they could do. And even with all that, the things that we learn about, you know, we, now when we study about this period, you know, Shvasi, Tammuz, Tisha B'Av, you know, five things on Shvasi, the five things on Israel. This is not one of them. I mean, it's also a problem, but to say that this is the reason the temple was destroyed, it's harsh. It's just, you know, it was a problem that maybe, you know, it typified, you know, the Sinat, you know, but I have a hard time, as you said, you could identify with all aspects. Now that we know what the Romans did, who they were, getting rid of Bar Kamtza at the end would have been better, but we learned also in the very beginning at the party that they didn't stand up and say something to Kanto, whoever, you know,
to the host.
Authorities, right.
Yeah. Double,
so there's double. A lot of things here and a lot of messages, but you just take even the wisest people get it wrong sometimes. I don't know what to say. I mean, you know.
So that's another point to ponder. The rabbis were present at this meal and they didn't interfere when the host acted.
Yeah,
and they didn't interfere over here. Okay, so that I'm saying this goes with the understanding that the rabbis should have understood the threat that Bar Kamtza represented.
Right. Seemingly they were intimidated by the host, who was a very prominent person, and they knew it wasn't proper to embarrass this person in that way, right? I mean, in a normal situation, people might pull the host aside, whatever you have against them, you know.
Okay, but the point here is Rabbi Yochanan gave us a story with many, right, many scenes.
Yeah.
And he chose to pull out this one and blame Rabbi Zechariah. So yeah. Rabbi Yochanan is saying the leadership here,
right,
was too humble.
At that stage, no question. Yeah.
Okay, that's a point we should remember. It comes up in other scenarios also.
Sure. We talked about it. I mean, you know, the threats to tradition and threats to things, and sometimes, right, of course.
Yes.
Yeah, I guess I'm just sort of wondering, within the story, is there any indication of, and maybe I missed something, I'm a little tired, but is there any indication of an attempt to negotiate with Bar Kamtza? I mean, because they realize the situation, they realize who brought the blemished calf, so is there any indication that they kind of came to them and they said...
In this story, we don't have it. The Talmud doesn't tell us anything. In other sources, it seems that Bar Kamtza let them know that he was following and he was going to report back to the Roman Emperor and he was watching which animal they would bring. So it seems he laid the law to them.
Okay.
Now this isn't so far-fetched in the sense that when you read Josephus, you see that there were people who could access the Emperor. There were definitely that you had the ability through the Senate to access the emperor when you thought a grievance was done in your country. This could be done. Yes?
Is the issue that there's a penalty if a non-kosher animal is brought on the altar?
The issue is that an animal that's wounded could not be brought on the altar.
So I thought in Torah it says anything that touches the altar is pure.
It says that whatever goes up is sanctified. We understand from that after something was sacrificed and the meats were brought up on top of the altar, you don't take them down from there. But here the question was before they did anything.
There's death penalty for them?
There is not the death penalty for that, and that's what they were saying. If they would execute Bar Kamtza, people would misunderstand. They would think that you get the death penalty for wounding a sacrifice or a sacrificial animal.
But the implications, they should have done it anyway.
Don't you just have to pay for it?
Right, but they didn't have who to talk to with Bar Kamtza. Meaning the issue here wasn't paying. The emperor sent an animal and he's testing them. Are you loyal to me or not? I want you to see if you'll sacrifice the animal. Bar Kamtza wounds the animal. The rabbis are conscious of what Bar Kamtza did. Now they say, let's bring the animal anyways, because otherwise we're endangering all of us.
Yeah.
And Rabbi Zecharia ben Avkula says, no, you'll end up destroying everything. People will think even blemished animals could be brought. The rabbis say, then let's kill Bar Kamtza. He shouldn't report back to the emperor that we didn't sacrifice the animal. They'll say, no. They'll think that for blemishing an animal, you get the death penalty. Now, I'll tell you a pshat, my own pshat, and I don't know if this is true. But I wonder if this discussion did not represent where they were trying to fix what had happened at the meal. Where Rabbi Zecharia ben Avkulis, why is it about a blemished animal? Where Rabbi Zecharia ben Avkulis wants to say, you can't treat a blemished animal so severely. If you offer it, people will think it can go up. But if you kill him, they'll think that for blemishing an animal, you get the death penalty. Is there also an allusion here to the idea that Bar Kamtza was blemished and kicked out of the meal? That on the one hand, you don't blemish the animal. On the other hand, don't kill someone for blemishing the animal. A blemished animal is not what we want to sacrifice before God. But you still don't kill someone for blemishing the animal. Is there an allusion to another idea here about the idea of coming close to God where you aspire for perfection but don't kill anyone who's short of perfection? I don't know. I'm suggesting. Yes?
With that analogy, it seems like, they didn't say anything at the meal and then Bar Kamtza got very mad. And then now they're in this situation and they're still taking the same position as they took in the first situation, and now it's just kind of like... Is this, they're having the same opinion the first scene, the second scene, and then the temple is going to be destroyed because of their logic.
But you see, on the first scene, Rabbi Yochanan is not blaming them. He's blaming this scene.
Because this is the second time you're doing it?
I don't know. I don't know why you didn't blame the first one.
Is it an illusion that what they did the first time was wrong, or...
I don't know. I don't know why Rabbi Yochanan focuses on the second scene. Shadar alayu le Niron Kesar. So he sent Niron to destroy the temple, to put down the rebellion, the perceived rebellion. Kikati shadagir le Mizrach. He shot an arrow to the east. Atanafal b'Yerushalayim, and the wind pushed it to Jerusalem. Le'ma'arav, he shot an arrow to the west. Atanafal b'Yerushalayim, the wind blew it into Jerusalem. Al baruchot ha'shamayim, atanafal b'Yerushalayim. Every direction he shot his arrows, the winds knocked them into Jerusalem. Amalei le'inuk ha'psok li'psukich. He met a Jewish child. He said, "What verse did you learn today?" Amalei said the verse, "V'natatit nikmati be'edom bi'adami Yisrael." God says, "I will take my revenge from Edom through my nation Israel." Amar, so Niron said to himself, "The Holy One wants to destroy his own home, and he's going to ultimately cleanse his hands of that man, of himself, of my people. If I destroy the temple, God wants it done now. I see, I shoot my arrows in every direction, they land in Jerusalem. But God's ultimately going to pay back whoever destroys his home." Arak, so he ran away from his position. He said, "Bad idea, I shouldn't be the one to do this." V'azal v'igayr, he went and converted to Judaism. Converted to Judaism, wow.
This was who again?
Niron.
Whoa.
V'nafak minei Rabbi Meir. And so Rabbi Meir was a descendant of his. Shadrei Luyal Vespasianus Kesar. So he sent Vespasian. Ata Tzaralayu Tlatcheni. Vespasian lay siege for 3 years. Havubu Anu Tlat Atirei. There were 3 wealthy people in Jerusalem. Nachtimon Ben Guyon Ben Kalbasavov and Tzitzita Keset. 3 wealthy individuals. Nachtimon Ben Kalbasavov and Ben Tzitzita Keset. Technically, each one represents a different merit that was in Jerusalem. Nachtimon Ben Guyon, Shenakdalo Chama Bavro. Nachtimon cared about the people so much that he took on personal loans to ensure that the people had enough water. One time there was no water to be had. Everyone was going up to the festival, to be all the regal. There was no water. He personally went and bought many pits of water the people could drink from. And he told the person he bought them from, this Roman philanthropist, he said, this Roman wealthy person, he said to him, I'll give you back by this and this date, either your pits filled with water or a certain amount of gold. Yes, sir. That's what we'll see in a second. So the day of payback came and the pits were empty. And so the Roman sent him word and said, give me my money, my pits are empty. You said you'd give by this date either the money back or the pits filled with water back. So Nachtimon said, the day isn't done yet. He said, all season long, it hasn't rained. Do you think it's going to rain today? Nachtimon and Gordon said, it's not over. Came midday again, he sent word to him. He said, the day's not over. So the afternoon is coming, the Roman goes to the shower house all happy, he's going to make a lot of money, and Nachtimon goes to the temple to pray, and he says, Rabban Shalom, you know I didn't do this for my honor or my father's honor, I did it for your honor. Your children came to ascend to your home, they had no water. So the sky got filled with clouds, it started pouring rain, and when the Roman comes out of the bathhouse, he sees it's pouring torrents, and all his wells, all his pits are filled with water. So Nachtimon Ben Gurion meets him and he says, I know that God only made the world do this for you, but I still have a claim, because by the time the rain fell, it was nighttime, and the rain fell into my pits. You never paid me back. You still owe me the money. So Nachtimon Ben Gurion didn't about face, and he went back into the temple and he said, God, I need your help. He's making claims. So the wind came and scattered the clouds, and you saw the sun out. And that's why it says, Nachdalo Chama, the sun shone on his behalf. That's the end of the story. So you had this wealthy person, Nachtimon Ben Gurion, who could take a huge loan, and who could buy water for all the people of Jerusalem, and that's how kind he was. So Nachtimon Ben Gurion was one philanthropist in Jerusalem. Number two, we had Ben Kalba Savua, Rabbi Akiva's father-in-law, that he had a soup kitchen. His house was a soup kitchen. You'd enter his house hungry as a dog, Kalba Savua. You'd walk out satiated. So again, if our stress is that people were not kind enough, as we will see, the temple was destroyed over Sinat Chinam. The Talmud tells us, but you had 3 giants in Jerusalem who were giants in kindness. And technically, their kindness could have overcome the destruction, the imminent destruction of the Romans. So you have Ben Kalba Savua, and then Ben Tzitzita Keset, who was careful in the mitzvah, that even his tzitzis would be supported, and it says wherever he went, they would spread out fine silk so that his tzitzis wouldn't touch the earth. And after he passed, the fine silk was given to the poor so that they could make money off it. Technically, the silk was there so that as he'd walk, his tzitzis were supported by silk. He didn't have silk for himself. The silk was there for his tzitzis. And then whenever he'd continue going, the poor would collect that silk and the poor would be able to sustain themselves from it. So again, you have very wealthy people who are very focused on helping their fellow man. Yes?
That's a very arrogant way to give charity.
I don't know, you could look at it that way, but you could also look at it as if something's left behind for free for whoever wants to take, so that's no different than leket and shikha and peya. It's a way of giving people. Everyone knew that wherever he went, he left behind. Imagine a person walks and just lets money fall out of his pockets. So you could say, isn't that arrogant? Or you could say, no one has to know. You go to a simcha today.
at the end of the Simcha here in Israel, I don't know why, it's a given that people take plates of food and bring them home. It's shocking to me, but it's the social norm here. People fill plates to bring home. So I remember in the United States, you'd make a breakfast, a bris, so people would take a bagel or two home. That was the norm there. But here, people are filling plates. It means that when you make a simcha, you need to provide much more food. But I know someone that when he makes a simcha, his intention is that the poor people will have a good meal. So when he makes a simcha, he makes sure to bring a lot of chulent, and he basically makes a whole Shabbos meal at his simchas, and he figured out a way to make a kiddush every Shabbos, so that every Shabbos there's a kiddush and shul, ostensibly because it's a shul kiddush, but the real reason is that the poor people get food that Shabbos. They get a good hot meal every Shabbos morning. Now, is that arrogant? Or can everyone come and say, everyone else is taking, I don't, no one knows who needs it and who doesn't. So I could imagine that fine silk was something that a lot of people would take. You didn't have to be poor. If there was fine silk lying on the roads every day, anyone could come and pick it up. So there's a little bit of embarrassment, but not as much as if you had to go collecting charity from him. Everyone knew he'd go to shul in the morning, he'd come back, you'd have a row of silk in the morning, a row of silk in the afternoon. No one knew if you took it because you needed it or you wanted to make new drapes in your house. No one has to know why you're taking it. I agree that it's still you're taking something, but he doesn't have to see who's taking it.
Taking something, because with the water that was very good, you know, purely for charity and the soup kitchen. But you know, to have like a silk that I don't know, because you're just to me it sounds like a demonstration of wealth. Like you're all groveling at your feet, and I walk on this because. I have so much money, this means nothing to me.
Who told you he walked on it? His tzitzis were on it.
So he had two lines.
Perhaps. Perhaps.
I understood it that it was like a rug of a...
That's not what I described, though. It's not what the Talmud describes. The Talmud says his tzitzis went on silk, which would sound like there were two lines of silk to the side, wherever he'd walk. Otherwise, it should have been known as the man who walks on silk, and that's not how he was known. Perhaps where he walked was the ground, and only his tzitzis went on the silk, and so that's maybe how the silk remained clean and valuable. I don't know. I wasn't there. But yes?
It could be he was a silk trader or something. That's the currency he had. I mean, we use money all the time now, but back then they used commodities as a much more.
So one of them said to the people, I have enough wheat and barley. I'll feed all of you with wheat and barley. So again, you see the charity. You see that the leadership cared about the people. The wealthy people cared about the poor. I will support all of you, he said to the people in the city, with wine and salt and oil. I have enough wood for all of you. Now in Jerusalem, wood is hard to find. You don't have wood growing in Jerusalem. He said, I have enough wood for the whole city. And the rabbi said the wood was most precious. They had 21 years of sustenance in the city. So the city is prepared because of unity. The city is prepared because people care. And so the city can stand up to the Roman siege. As powerful as the Romans are, they can stand up to them. And even if one man has chosen to break with his people and turn on them and get the Romans upset at them, the rest of the people have these great leaders, they can last. The unity is what allows them to stand up to the Romans. But amongst them were these people called Birione, these gangsters. The rabbi said to them, we should go and make peace with the Romans. It says that when Neron first came, Neron said to them, all I want is you should send out an arrow to me. Arrow was the sign of peace. send out a message that you accept that we are the leaders, what we would call today a white flag. If you show that you surrender to the Roman rule, we're not interested in a war. And they refused. The rabbi said, why do you refuse? We'll lose. Let's agree. Yes?
Was this refusal based on an issue of lack of trust in the Romans?
No, the Romans were very trustworthy. On the contrary, and the Romans stood everything to lose. They had everything to lose if they wouldn't be trustworthy, because then other nations wouldn't agree to make peace. The Romans had their reputation on the line. It happens to be, in Josephus he records, that this was a time where rebellions were brewing in other places of Africa. And that's why the Birionim thought politically that the Romans were spread too thin, that if there are enough rebellions going on, they figured we'll do a rebellion here. The rebellion's brewing in Africa, and then as the Romans try to quell these rebellions, other states will rebel in kind, which actually happened. And then the Romans won't be able to put down the rebellion over here. That was the thought process. But the rabbis said it's not going to work.
So they were trying to lead a rebellion. Like, Birionim, were they like warriors?
The Birionim were worse than warriors, as we will see. Yes?
The people that fought in, that went to Masada, it was the same people, right?
We'll get there.
But they were actually, a lot of them were elite Christians.
We'll get there.
When I meant warriors, I meant were they trying to fight? Are they fighting Romans? I mean, in modern Hebrew, Birion is like someone who's very strong.
Over here, the idea is a gangster. The idea is one who will enforce his opinion by brute force. It's not a compliment. So the rabbi said to them, let's go make peace with the Romans. Lo shavkinu. They wouldn't let the rabbis go out. Amru lehu nepuk v'nevit krava ba'adayu. The Birionim said, we should wage war against them. Amru lehu rabbanan lo mestaya milta. The rabbi said to them, you won't succeed. You want to fight a war? You're not going to win. Now, we did not have an organized army throughout the Second Temple period. We were not organized as an army. We were always subservient. And the Romans were the most organized army in world history at that time. The Romans had everything prepared. Everything was down to a science, and their soldiers were well trained. And we didn't really stand a chance. But the rabbis had a tradition that we shouldn't be fighting the Romans. And so the rabbi said, don't do it. Now, when you read Josephus, you read about the cruelty of the Birionim. That they were prepared to murder Jews. They were prepared to murder anyone who stood in their way. as we will see in a minute. So these were Jews, but these were Jews who were gangsters. Kamu, so the Birionim got up. Kalanu lehanu amavre dechite vesare. They burnt the storage houses of the wheat and the barley. So Rashi says, what are Birionim? People who are empty and quick to fight. People who are interested in war. So there's no more storage houses. No more grain, no more trees. V'havikafna. So famine breaks out. And that's their logic to force the Jews to fight. Now, there were Jews who wanted to turn over to the Romans. They saw they have no chance. So the Birionim would kill them. So there were Jews who tried to sneak out to the Romans. And some succeeded. Later on, the Romans discovered that the Jews would swallow gold and silver and jewelry and then take it out of their feces. So when the Jews would come out, the Romans had a practice. They'd punch them in the stomach and grab their intestines and pull them out and check in their intestines to see what was there. Jews would be killed brutally by the Romans and killed brutally inside Jerusalem. Now, at one point, the Birionim told the Romans, we want to make peace. So they agreed on a time and they came out and the Romans came for peace. And then they turned on them and they attacked them and they killed many Romans. And that made the Romans infurious because the Romans said, we trusted you. And Vespasian himself almost got killed at that time. This is recorded in Josephus. And what is Josephus? There was a man who was a Kohen, and he was in charge of one of the forces. His name was Josephus Flavius. And after his battalion was taken, he remained in hiding. And while he remained in hiding, the Romans couldn't catch him until finally he came to the Romans and he said to Vespasian, hail be the emperor, hail be the emperor. And just as he came in, he had good luck. And right after he came in, a message came from Rome that Vespasian was appointed emperor. Now, he heard, rumors were floating all around that Vespasian would be appointed emperor. So he told them, I'm a prophet, Josephus said to the people. Josephus was a Jew. It's not clear whether, it's not clear whether Josephus was an observant Jew or he was more like a Sadducee. That's a discussion among the researchers. But Josephus told them he was a prophet, and then he did a few more shenanigans to get them to believe that he was a prophet, and then they honored him. And being that he had told Vespasian he would be emperor, so Vespasian was very pleased, his prophecy came true. And then Josephus was given royal treatment, and he was hired to record the events of the destruction of the temple. Josephus was written in Latin and
Greek.
Okay.
Yeah, for sure.
And it wasn't translated for many years. But there was a book that no one knows who authored called Yosifun, written in Hebrew. And Josephus says he would like to write a book for his own people. We don't know if he ever did that. Some want to suggest that Yosifun is Josephus' work for his own people. In Yosifun, there are differences between Josephus Flavius and Yosifun. But Yosifun was the book that was accessible to the Rishonim, to the early commentaries. Rashi quotes from it. And what's interesting is that there are huge discrepancies between the description of the destruction we're going to see here and the description in Josephus, in Yosifun. And the commentaries, we would have said that Josephus was hired by the Romans, so he had to write history in a way that complemented the Romans. But that's not the approach the Malbim and the Maharal take. The Malbim and the Maharal look at Yosifun as an authentic source, and they say we have to interpret the Gemara a little differently. They, as we'll see, as we move on, we'll see the Gemara, and we'll compare as we go along. But so we have in Hebrew Yosifun, and today we have translations of Josephus Flavius. He wrote a few books, but in his books he describes things, in certain things he's very different from our tradition. And again, the question is, was he a Karaite? Was he a Sadducee? How much weight should we give to the things he describes? He describes that they had a special fuel which they could use to keep the fire burning all the time on the altar. Chazal say it was a miracle. He says there was a secret fuel they had in a certain cave, and when they threw that on the altar, that was a fuel that could last hundreds of years. And that's how they kept the fire burning on the altar. Again, if Rashi wouldn't have given him credence, if the Bach and the commentaries and the laws of Shabbos, where it says you're not supposed to read secular studies on Shabbos. So it says, but Yosifun is okay. So you see, they treated Yosifun as a good book. Again, do we trust everything he says? Some of the things he says. Rashi interprets the book of Daniel in a few places. He says in Josephus it says this. And he treats it as a good source. I don't know. Yes.
I don't know, I think...
Okay. Yes, Adam.
He's called Josephus. His last name is Netanyahu or Ben Netanyahu.
I don't know. I don't remember. Ben Matityahu. Ben Matityahu, you mean? Yes.
You mentioned that Rashi uses Josephus
swords.
Yosifun.
Yes, in regards to the Book of Daniel, is that what the date, the week, the amount of time, is that where he uses that?
No. No. In his description of the kings and the evolvement of the kings, he also in his explanation of why Jericho is called Jericho, in a few places in Tanakh, he quotes from Yosifun that you could smell Jericho from out in the sea, that Jericho used to have such wonderful fruits growing that from the sea, from the Mediterranean, I guess, you could smell the fruits of Jericho. And Yosifun says that's why it's called Yericho. I assume he means the Mediterranean and not the Jordan. I assume he says Ma'ayam. I think that's what it says. I don't think so, but I don't know. Got to look it up. I don't know. I'm quoting from memory. I don't know. Yes.
Okay. I'm gonna ask this. Are there any other opinions among the rabbis about what? Who could have offered Yosef besides Josephus? Is the general thought generally leaning towards Josephus? No?
No, the general thought is actually that it was plagiarized, that someone came across Josephus Flavius and understood it,
okay. And
decided to make it accessible to the Jews, and he reworked it in Hebrew, making his own changes from Josephus to Yosefun. The thought is that it's not Josephus's work. We don't have sources actually supporting that Yosifun is actually Josephus. The thought is that someone, maybe in his generation, maybe later, because it's been around for a long time, someone came across Josephus Flavius, made a translation, but altered the translation. Why? How much? Did he have better information? Is that why he altered it? Did he have an agenda? All of that's a good question. We don't know.
I think there's actually a small section that when Josephus talks about Yeshu, that Christians actually threw in something there as well, somewhere the same thing.
Could be.
Anyway.
I heard that they didn't like him so much because he doesn't make any mention of it.
He doesn't, right. I don't remember him mentioning Yeshu at all. Right. I actually have... okay, we're out of time.